Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Redistricting and One Person, One Vote Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 8, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Harris v. Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. In 2012, the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission redrew the map for the state legislative districts based on the results of the 2010 census. Wesley Harris and other individual voters sued the commission and alleged that the newly redrawn districts were underpopulated in Democratic-leaning districts and overpopulated in Republican-leaning ones, and that the commission had therefore violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The commission countered that the population deviations were the result of attempts to comply with the Voting Rights Act. A three-judge district court ruled in favor of the commission. There are two questions before the Supreme Court on appeal. One, whether the desire to gain partisan advantage for one political party justifies creating overpopulated legislative districts that result in the devaluation of individual votes, violating the one-person, one-vote principle. And two, whether the desire to obtain favorable preclearance review by the Justice Department permits the creation of legislative districts that deviate from the one-person, one-vote principle. And even if creating unequal districts to obtain preclearance approval was once justified, whether this remains a legitimate justification after the court's decision in Shelby County v. Holder. To discuss the case, we have Mark F. Hearn II, who is partner at Arendt Fox, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Hearn.
Before I talk specifically about the Harris case, let me set the table a little bit by providing some sense of the context in which this case arises. And I would say there's basically three concepts that inform both the argument and what we believe will ultimately be the decision in the case. Those three concepts are partisanship, preclearance, and proof. So partisanship refers to the degree to which partisanship can influence, to what extent is it permissible, influencing the reapportionment of a state legislature. And I'll come back to that in a second. The second point has to do with the preclearance, which was, in our case, used as a justification for deviating from the constitutional principle of one person, one vote. And then finally, there's going to be the question of what degree of proof, what's the standard of proof or the burden of proof that a party must establish if they're going to successfully challenge a malapportioned reapportionment scheme for a specific state legislature. So those are the three points that I think frame the argument. I'll talk first, before getting into our case, about the prior case, because if those who have had a chance to read the transcript, or if you later look at the or listen to the audio of the argument, it's difficult to fully appreciate the interaction between the justices and the justices in counsel without also understanding the context of the prior case. So the prior case was the Arizona Legislature versus Arizona Redistricting Commission. The history is this. The state of Arizona, through a citizens' initiative petition, amended their constitution to remove redistricting or reapportionment, both congressional as well as Arizona state House and Senate, from the legislature. And they removed the responsibility or even any role at all from the legislative or elective process more than any other state. The commission was really rather dramatic. What it is a commission that is appointed by another commission. So you have another commission puts forward two lists, one supposedly Republican, one supposedly Democrat. They have a list of 10 people on each, and then the leaders of the House and Senate choose from those two supposedly Republican members and two supposedly Democrat members. Out of those four members, then choose from another list that is also put forward by this also, quote, independent commission, a, quote, independent chairman who will is a independent, meaning not registered as a Republican or a Democrat. That's the context of the commission. The way the commission this time actually worked is the fifth person they picked was a highly partisan activist. It betrayed the ideal that the entire process was set up to achieve, which was to remove partisanship from redistricting, either congressional or state legislative. So what happened next? Here's what happened. The commission met. While the commission was commencing their work, it became very clear to everyone that it was becoming very partisan, not doing what was intended. The Arizona legislature and governor, with two-thirds vote in the Senate, sought to remove the chairman from the commission because she was failing in her duties and it was so partisan. Nonetheless, the Arizona Supreme Court overturned that and said that the state legislature and Governor Brewer did not have the ability to remove the chairman from the commission, so they validated the commission's authority and let the commission proceed. The commission then devised two different districting schemes, one for the congressional races, one for the state house. I'll talk about each very quickly. The congressional district, they had another congressional district, so they apportioned those districts. Now, in the congressional districts, they did so equally, apportioning the population equally into each congressional district. Congressional districts are apportioned by state legislatures under the Election Clause, Article 1, Section 4, which says the state, quote, legislature shall apportion each state's districts for electing congressional representatives. Congress has an overriding ability to, if you will, adjust that. That doesn't come into play. The issue in the first case, which Paul Clement argued and argued very well, was whether or not the word legislature does or doesn't include a five-member independent commission that has no accountability to any legislative body and is essentially entirely unaccountable to the political process. Paul Clement argued for the Arizona State Legislature that no, of course, that is not what the Constitution meant. When Congress said that the state shall be apportioned by the legislature, they meant the elected legislature, not some independent commission that was unaccountable. That decision came out in June. In June, the majority written by Ginsburg said that the word legislature would include a independent commission such as this. That decision was written over a rather scathing dissent authored by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Scalia, Alito, and Thomas. Thomas and Scalia, both separately and additionally wrote separate dissents. It was a pretty contentious dissent. Scalia particularly noted the point that there's no rational way to conclude that the word capital L legislature used in the Constitution ever intended to mean an unelected commission such as this. But be that as it may, that was the decision. So you have a 5-4 decision validating the constitutional authority of the commission to, in fact, apportion Arizona's congressional districts. And that was the end of that case. At the same day that the court announced their decision in that case, the court announced that they would take this case. So this case is the same commission doing the same thing, apportioning Arizona's legislature, but in this case, it's the Arizona State Legislature. Traditionally, the court has afforded greater discretion for principals, those who share federalism principles and concerns for state sovereignty would recognize, have recognized the deference a federal court should afford a state when a state is engaged in the sovereign function of apportioning its own state legislature. So whereas in prior decisions, the court has had a more strict requirement of one person, one vote when congressional districts are drawn, it tends to defer a little more to states when state legislative districts are drawn. But traditionally, the only deference has been afforded for things such as a county boundaries, preserving a single county in the same legislative district. There's never been a decision by the court affording a excuse to deviate from one person, one vote for any reason such as partisanship or to comply with some bad advice about what the Voting Rights Act requires. Now, I'll come to that in just a second. So that was the case we framed. The lower court, which is a three-judge district court, had a trial. They looked into how it was that the commission came up with these districts. The trial found that the commission, this five-member Democrat-dominated, as it turned out, and was very clearly so, commission, and it doesn't really matter, frankly, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. The point that was prevailing was that it was a partisan objective, that this commission malapportioned the Arizona legislature with deviations of up to 8.8% from the ideal one person, one vote. In other words, they diluted the votes of 3.9 million Arizona citizens and overweighted the votes of 2.5 million Arizona citizens to achieve a specific objective. And that specific objective, actually two specific objectives, were number one, to gain a partisan advantage for the Democrat Party, and number two, to what they claimed was achieve preclearance under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, this whole preclearance pretext becomes more interesting because of the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County. Shelby County, of course, the Supreme Court struck down the Section 4B formula by which Arizona and other jurisdictions were covered under the Section 5 preclearance. I'm assuming everybody's familiar with that, but I'll belabor the point just a step. Section 5 is very unusual. It's very extraordinary. It's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act says we are going to require states, before they can make any change in the election device or procedure, to first submit it to either the Justice Department or to the district court in Washington, D.C., to have that procedure approved. In other words, it's a statutory injunction that intrudes rather dramatically, not rather, but very dramatically, upon state sovereignty. It says the federal government now trumps any state election procedure, and none of those are valid until you get our permission. It's a mother may I in terms of federalism. So that is a substantial intrusion into traditional principles of federalism and state sovereignty. Notwithstanding, because of the racial situation in the 1960s and following really the implementation of that and the Voting Rights Act, the court has tolerated that, but they've always recognized it's exceptional. So in Shelby County, the court, again, in a 5-4 decision with the majority, which included Kennedy, in a decision written by Justice Roberts, it said this formula is no longer rational because it's including states that don't have a rational relation to a legitimate, overwhelming objective of the federal government sufficient to intrude into these principles of state sovereignty and federalism. The decision in Shelby County concerned Shelby County, Alabama. That decision was particularly apropos to Arizona because the history in Arizona was never subject to the Voting Rights Act until 1975. In 1975, when Congress reauthorized it, it became subject to it really by a quirk because Arizona in 1901 had had a literacy test, but that literacy test was repealed in 1972. And in fact, Arizona had bilingual ballots. So there's no legitimate reason for Arizona to have been included in the Voting Rights Act coverage, yet it was under the formula that Congress wrote. So that's a particularly rich irony that sort of colors the background of this case. So all of that said, in this case, the commission said we have, and the district court below found a majority of all three of the members agreed on this. This commission was driven by an objective to achieve a partisan advantage for the Democratic Party, number one. And then number two, this commission had the mistaken belief that they needed to malapportion, in other words, underpopulate certain Hispanic districts, 10 Hispanic districts, in order to gain preclearance approval from the Justice Department. Now, why did they believe that? They believed that because they hired a Democrat consultant who told them that. So the question in part in this case becomes, does bad legal advice from a Democrat consultant excuse or immunize a commission from malapportioning 3.9 million Arizona voters' votes, in other words, diluting their votes? We would say no. That was the issue. Those were the two issues the Supreme Court took, and that was the context in which the argument was made. When I began, I said there were three points that tended to inform this case, the first being partisanship, the second being preclearance, and the third being proof. So as to partisanship and preclearance, again, the two justifications were, does partisanship ever allow a redistricting authority to deviate from the constitutional principle of one person, one vote? We argue no. The court below, all three judges, assumed that it was an illegitimate purpose. So you have an illegitimate purpose for the malapportioned legislature. Then the question shifts to, well, does the fact that their advisor, a fellow named Bruce Adelson, told them wrongly, bad legal advice, that doing this was necessary to obtain preclearance? We have two responses to that. The first is, you can't have a unequally populated districts on that belief, because the Voting Rights Act itself is a statute. A statute cannot command or compel a violation of the U.S. Constitution, the one person, one vote principle. So his advice was entirely wrong. The fact that two members or three members of the commission had a, quote, good faith belief that what he was telling them was accurate does not exonerate them from that. And that's a clear point in the Supreme Court's Shaw series of cases, that bad legal advice doesn't excuse a malapportioned or racially malapportioned district. So that was our response on that point. But one of the fundamental features, and it was a point that we developed much more during our preparation for oral argument, and I'm greatly indebted to Mike Carvin for all of his comments on this point, which really helped us sharpen the point, was the fact that it's the burden of proof. And so there's a series of famous cases in other contexts called Mount Healthy and Arlington Heights. What they say is that when you have a mixed motive case, which everyone admits this is a mixed motive. So there's two motives. Motive one is, we did this to help the Democrats, that's illegitimate. Mixed motive two, we did it because we had to obtain preclearance. We dispute that motive, but assuming it's legitimate, we now have two motives, one purportedly legitimate, one illegitimate. When you have mixed motives as a justification to violate a constitutional right or a fundamental right, what you then look at is a burden shift. So that point was brought up particularly by Justice Alito, who specifically referenced Mount Healthy. And the obligation that once we'd established, which we being the voters in Arizona, had established that the commission had one illegitimate motive benefiting the Democrats for what they did, at that point then the burden shifted to the commission to prove that the illegitimate motive was not in fact why they did it, but in fact it was the quote legitimate motive of preclearance. That was discussed between Justice Alito and, again, I think Justice Kagan also, as I recall, brought that up, referencing the Bush v. Vera case, where the question that she had is, well, shouldn't the evidential or burden of proof standard require the plaintiff to not only show that there was an illegitimate motive, but also to show that the illegitimate motive predominated. So that is a final factor that will be considered in the course of this decision. That's what I'm referring to in the third criteria of proof as a theme that will emerge from this case. The comments between the various justices as the case was argued tended very much, particularly Justice Scalia versus Justice Breyer, to reflect the justices' decision in last term's decision of the Arizona legislature versus the commission. Justice Scalia specifically said, well, isn't it interesting? I just wish we'd had this case before we had the last case. Maybe we could have gotten that one right, or something to very close to that effect. Justice Ginsburg, the author of that decision, sought to defend because let me step back a half step. I mean, on a policy matter, the four liberals like this notion of independent, nonpartisan redistricting commissions. They think that's wonderful. I mean, it sort of works with NPR. I mean, it sounds so above the fray. If we could only have redistricting done by politically unaccountable, what Justice Scalia called, quote, divine commissions that are removed from the hurly-burly of politics, we would have much fairer districting. That was not a position, certainly, that's shared by what I'd call the realist faction in the court. And then the one person sort of swinging back and forth between the two is, not surprisingly, Justice Kennedy, who, as he looks at it, doesn't like partisanship, because you read his opinion in some cases such as Veith, where he separately concurred. He doesn't like the notion of partisanship, but he also recognizes the realistic impossibility of the court trying to ferret out partisanship from the political redistricting process. So what you have is, again, your sort of typical 4-4 with Kennedy in the middle on that issue. But the other issue that's running at cross currents to that is this issue of sovereignty and state federalism principles. So why should we have federal courts intruding in the state as they exercise one of the quintessential state sovereign functions of apportioning their own legislature? So in that sense, particularly going into the oral argument, I was concerned that Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, and to a lesser degree Robertson Alito would be very sensitive to that concern, as I am personally as well. The concern says we don't want to open the door for federal courts to get in at minor deviations and second guess every little decision some state makes. Two responses that I propose to that. One is, well, first off, this wasn't the state of Arizona legislature doing this redistricting. That was obvious from the fact that the Attorney General of Arizona was on my side sitting at the council table, also supporting our position, as was the Secretary of State and the legislature of Arizona and the governor of Arizona, all opposed what the commission did. So you cannot say that it was actually a Arizona legislature that was engaged in this. So there's not that same level of deference. Now, that speaks to Justice Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito's concern. But beyond that, the issue that Justice Ginsburg wanted to do was to try to defend the, quote, nonpartisanship of the commission. And she said, well, they didn't do a very good job, did they? Because after they were done with their reapportionment, we did have an election, and in that election, the Republicans still control the majority of the Arizona House and Senate. So if you think this was a political gerrymander, it was a very ineffective one. My response to that was to note that an incompetent gerrymander is no less a gerrymander when you're diluting the votes of a significant, in this case, 3.9 million Arizona voters or Arizona people, another issue to discuss in the context of EMWL. You are nonetheless violating the court's one person, one vote principle. So that's the context of the case. That's from the context that colored the argument. And I would say, in conclusion to my introductory remarks, that this is a case that does provide the court an opportunity, given each individual justice's unique perspective, to go back and really integrate the original Baker v. Carr from 1962 and the 1964 reapportionment decisions, including Reynolds and Westbury and the others, and try to come forward with a coherent principle that provides a clear justiciable standard for states when they reapportion state legislatures. What I actually think they'll probably do is look at this case, and the easy way out is to look at what Justice Alito was referring to, which was the Mount Healthy evidence burden standard, a likely or potential outcome would be that it's remanded to the district court with directions to evaluate the commission's defense of their malapportionment and require the burden shift to them since we have established an illegitimate motive, and now let them come forward with some excuse or some justification for their excuse that in fact it was malapportioned because they had to do so to comply with the preclearance requirements. And that would be a position that I don't believe the commission could succeed in maintaining.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.